That's Freedom Jazz Dance by Eddie Harris. It's from his 1965 album, The In Sound. Miles Davis would record his own version the following year. We're hearing Eddie Harris on tenor sax, Ray Codrington on trumpet, Cedar Walton on piano, Ron Carter on bass, and Billy Higgins on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead. It is Tuesday. And 50 years ago today, the Watts neighborhood of Los Angeles, a tinderbox smoldering for decades under the yoke of poverty, disfranchisement, governmental indifference, and militarized police oppression, exploded in a cathartic rage. The heavy-handed arrest of a black motorist by white cops for drunk driving was a spark that set Watts aflame for 6 days and transformed it into a war zone, claiming 34 lives, causing more than $40 million in property damage, adding 4,000 National Guards, 934 city cops, and 71 sheriffs to the city's police force, and causing about 3,500 arrests. Half a century later, Ferguson, Missouri, is under its second state of emergency as the mostly black town of 21,000 observed the anniversary of the killing of 18-year-old Michael Brown by former police officer Darren Wilson on August the 9th last year. The community still is waiting for justice. Mainstream media until yesterday were touting headlines and news stories about change. Yesterday was a day that a group of right-wing militia members, organized as the Oath Keepers, all of them former military, police, and first responders, turned up in Ferguson, armed and ready for action to protect and defend, they say, the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Our guest, Dr. Gerald Horn, a diplomatic scholar, historian, attorney, and prolific author, draws stark parallels between Watts and Ferguson. Dr. Horn, as you know, is no stranger on this program. He is the John J. and Rebecca Morris Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. He has written more than 30 books and more than 100 scholarly papers and reviews on struggles against imperialism, colonialism, fascism, and racism. Pertinent to our discussion today is his authoritative account and analysis of the Watts Rebellion, book titled Fire This Time, The Watts Uprising and the 1960s. Gerald, great to have you with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
It's a very significant day, August the 11th. But I wanted to first say thanks for your work, because among many things you do, you look not strictly at politics, you look at the whole gamut. And you basically give us insights that we normally would not get at all. So perhaps you can link, and let's start there. What is the link between Watts and Ferguson, Missouri?
Well, it's not only the link between Watts and Ferguson, it's the link between Watts and Ferguson and Staten Island and Eric Garner and Cleveland and Tamir Rice and North Charleston and Walter Scott and Oakland and Oscar Grant. That is to say, these murderous encounters, particularly between people of African descent and the officers of the state. And you may recall that in many ways we've discussed the deeper causes for this phenomenon that keeps bubbling to the surface. The deepest cause, in my estimation, being the fact that if you look at the founding of the country now known as the United States of America, it was founded in no small part as a revolt against the fact that the colonial power, Britain, was moving towards abolition of slavery. Therefore, those who were enslaved, meaning the African population, did not think this revolt that led to the formation of the United States of America was a good idea, and they stood largely against it. And therefore, when you stand against a successful revolt, you should be expected to be punished and penalized and pulverized and stigmatized forevermore until and unless you can change the game. And that's what many of our ancestors did by lengthening the battlefield and turning our struggle into an international struggle. But that insight has been lost in the last half century or more, not least because of the formal attainment, if you like, of so-called citizenship, I think has dulled our senses. And in some ways, as was intended explicitly, gave some of our folk a stake in the system, a piece of the pie, making it more difficult for them to garner that insight that I've just articulated. And thus, you see this chain of police killings, oftentimes captured on videotape, which is the main difference between 2015 and 1965.
Well, let's talk about this change, this metamorphosis, if you will, of what seemed in the 1965 Watts, the rebellion of 1965, what seemed like a definitive point of modern day nationalism. What you said that it basically transformed because people, the leadership, I imagine, and others, found themselves wanting a piece of the pie as well, wanting to play ball. Has it happened to such a degree to completely wipe out nationalistic fervor?
Well, no, not completely. And there's the rub. And that disturbing report that you just rendered about the Oath Keepers showing up in Ferguson, something I hadn't noticed, I have to confess, in the numbers of news accounts that I've read, that was a real service that you've just provided. But before we get to the nub of the question, as you have articulated, let me give you a little background on Southern California, because setting and place are key here. First of all, the area of conflict, that is to say the so-called curfew zone where the flames were leaping to the sky, was approximately 46 and a half square miles, which is larger than Manhattan, larger than the city of San Francisco. The commission that investigated the conflagration, named after former CIA Director John McCone, the McCone Commission, estimated that perhaps tens of thousands of people came into the streets over the week beginning August 11th and culminating on August 18th. Approximately 34 people were killed. Overwhelmingly, they were of African descent. Hundreds were injured, and there were tens of millions of dollars in property damage, mostly of business interests. There were few libraries that were scathed, likewise for churches, likewise for residences for the most part, which helps to underscore the idea there was a certain intentionality despite the apparent spontaneity of this particular conflict. You should also know that the presence of black people in large numbers in Los Angeles and Los Angeles County in Southern California is of recent historical vintage, mostly beginning in late 1941, early 1942, when in the area stretching from Seattle to San Diego along the Pacific coast, you see the internment of the population of Japanese origin because of the Pacific War. And then you see how the U.S. authorities helped to entice and induce black people to move from Texas and Louisiana and Oklahoma to the West Coast, and therefore in Los Angeles, what was Little Tokyo becomes Bronzeville. Now, this is not to denigrate the idea that when the City of Angels was founded formally in the late 18th century under Spanish colonial rule, there were a number of people of African descent in that founding colony. Yet it's also fair to say that after the U.S. takeover from Spain during the illegal war of aggression, 1846 to 1848, there were not that many black people there, although you should know that part of what drove the takeover of the United States, of California in particular, and a good deal of the West and Southwest, was the fact that Mexico had moved towards abolition of slavery. In fact, that had induced, as you know already, the secession of Texas from Mexico in 1836, and then, of course, its acquisition by the United States as a state in 1845. And so Los Angeles, in particular, had a very strong white supremacist element, as reflecting the fact that it was a hotbed of Confederate sentiment during the U.S. Civil War. And that had not abated by 1965, when the city went up in flames. Now, what happens in the wake of August 1965 are halting steps towards affirmative action and inclusion, precisely because it was felt that this would help to chill out, if you like, a good deal of the population if they could begin to think that they could too aspire to the so-called American dream. But as you know, the so-called American dream is not reserved for all. It's only reserved for some. And inevitably, that breeds frustration, which exploded not only in August 1965, but in April-May 1992, after the officers involved in the beating of black motorist Rodney King were acquitted, though their act of aggression was captured on videotape. And that led to a conflagration that in many ways dwarfs the one of August 1965. And quite frankly, the kindling is still present for another conflagration in Los Angeles. In some ways, I mean that literally, because, as you know, there's a drought in California. There's a fire season in California right now. That makes it very possible for arsonists to run amok. And, of course, the underlying conditions of homelessness and hunger and unemployment continue to persist. In fact, with wages stagnating in Los Angeles as elsewhere, yet Southern California being one of the hottest real estate markets in the United States, if not the world, homelessness is just going off the charts there. In particular, note that since it's warm, it tends to attract people who feel that it's better to be homeless in Los Angeles than in Minneapolis. Hello?
When we look at 50 years, you know, I was remarking just last week when we played a speech by Lyndon Baines Johnson on signing the Voting Rights Act of 1965, but talking about the fact of the element of time. Now, I haven't seen a single media organization really link. I mean, this is if you're into anniversaries, because they're into anniversaries these days. We had the anniversary of the death of Eric Garner. We have the anniversary of Michael Brown. You know, they're very big on covering anniversaries. But I found a stark absence of any coverage relating to Watts 50 years down the pike. But a great deal of effort made to convey, even though initially it was, you know, kind of paternalistic and reassuring that to the public, that much has been gained since the killing of Michael Brown. Have you seen any connection that media organizations have made between Watts and Ferguson, or was there a reason for the absence of that link, you think?
Well, I think that there has been some attempt. I mean, I was on Al Jazeera this morning, and in the context of a longer piece on the state of emergency in Ferguson, I was interviewed about Watts and asked to comment on the connections between Ferguson and Los Angeles. And if you look at the newspapers, just by dint of the fact that there will be a front page story, for example, in the Los Angeles Times, on 50 years after Watson, then, of course, you turn to the continuation in the middle of the paper, and you'll find a story about Ferguson. So I do think that that inescapable connection has not necessarily been missed. But as I did, as I now repeat, I didn't notice any reference to the Oath Keepers showing up in Ferguson. I think that that's a very telling omission because, quite frankly, it's taking place in the context of this very dangerous shift to the right in the United States of America, with the police killings just being the tip of the iceberg, and this all taking place in the context of stagnant wages, of increased homelessness, of an unemployment picture that's spotty at best. And this is all something that needs to be digested by us all.
Is there a difference in both the tenor and in the action, the tenor of the rhetoric, if you will, or what people are saying, both in Watts and in Ferguson, to indicate a schism between what the people are saying and what they want, and what their so-called leadership is saying and what it wants?
Well, with regard to Watts, keep in mind that 1965 also marked the transformation of U.S. immigration policy, moving away, at least legally, from its Eurocentric bias. And that sets the stage for a huge influx of immigrants from Asia, Pacific, and Latin American nations, to the point now where Watts is about 70% Latino, where in 1965 it was about 80 to 90% Black. Now, this has provided a different kind of challenge for leaders. My own opinion is that in the short term, there is a congruence between what leaders articulate and what people want. I mean, in the short term, leaders are talking about health care and unemployment, and they're talking about homelessness. I think the problem in the United States, I don't see the real problem, even though I might complain about them, is the Black leadership. I think the problem is the country, it's dominated by the white right, and they are buoyed by transatlantic currents from their counterparts in Britain and in France and in Germany. And in that context, it's very difficult to get any traction. And then we have a left that doesn't like to talk about the fact, for example, Donald Trump, his base of support is coming from the white working class. That doesn't fit with the theory. And they're like the fictional French intellectuals who say, well, I know what you say makes sense in practice, but doesn't make sense in theory. And as a result, we're left bereft.
Well, you anticipated a question that I must raise, and that is, what's happening with the so-called left, especially the white left? Where is it in the scheme of things? I mean, we are not hearing this question of racism. We're not hearing white supremacy being discussed. We're not hearing about what, for example, Hillary Clinton, what other than the palliatives and, you know, the predictable, you know, the news bites that she would offer, and these things that have been said over and over and over again, which would lead one to believe that insincerity is really feeding all of that. But who is accountable here in white America for what is happening in Missouri or in Los Angeles?
Well, you're asking quite a bit there. Let me first of all repair to what I said a few moments ago, which is I think that part of the problem with the left in the United States is an inadequate grasp of the history of the country. In other words, instead of seeing the creation of the United States as the creation of an apartheid regime, perhaps the first on planet Earth, they see it as a great leap forward for humanity. Now, if you start out with that kind of mistaken conception, inevitably, it's going to be very difficult for you to make an accurate and adequate political estimate so as to curb the strength of the right in 2015. Having said that, you may have noticed that with the campaign of Bernie Sanders, the Democratic Socialist from Vermont, who's running for president, at least in Phoenix and Seattle, his public rallies have been interrupted by activists identified with Black Lives Matter who have challenged him on the question of institutional racism and what he plans to do about it. Now, of course, those activists have been criticized, some asking when are they going to disrupt Hillary Clinton's rallies or when are they going to disrupt, perhaps more to the point, Donald Trump's rallies. But in any case, I do think that what that bespeaks in the former case, that is the Sanders case, is this gap between the so-called leftism, democratic socialist leftism, and a black activist leftism. And it seems to me that if we had a more theoretically grounded left, that kind of gap would not exist. They would all be on the same page. But alas and alack, that is not the case.
What have we not learned from Watts?
Well, it's difficult to know where to begin. In my book, one of the things I say is that if you look at the retreat of Jim Crow in the 1950s and the 1960s, you'll see that it's bookended. That is to say that historically, the advance of black people in the United States has been oftentimes tied to global currents. That is to say that with the rise of independence movements in Africa, culminating in 1957 with independence of Ghana under Kwame Nkrumah, or, for example, a few years before, the Bandung meeting in Indonesia of mostly Asian and African colonized peoples, you begin to see a transformation of the plight of those who have been designated as colonized or, quote, colored, unquote. And that helps to give momentum to what we refer to as the civil rights movement, leading to Lyndon Johnson, as you noted, signing the Voting Rights Act of 1965, the crowning glory of the civil rights movement, a few days before Watts erupts in flames. But we should not stop there, because we also know that within weeks of Watts, you begin to see the counter-revolution take force. And the United States, as noted, is a country that has been the headquarters of counter-revolution. Historically, it started as a counter-revolution against abolition of slavery in 1776. And so in September, October 1965, you see a bloody overthrow of a nationalist regime in Indonesia, the same Indonesia that had hosted the Bandung meeting of 1955, with tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people slaughtered. And then in February 1966, you see the overthrow of the Kwame Nkrumah regime in Ghana under the aegis of a U.S. ambassador, Franklin Williams, a black American and former leader of the NAACP. I think if you begin to analyze that chain of events that I've just articulated, you begin to understand how and why this counter-revolution took force, which then, of course, had its crowning glory in November 1966, when Ronald Wilson Reagan was elected governor of California, launching his political career that lands him at the White House in November 1980, and he running in 1966 on a platform pledging that there would be no Watts 1965 or Berkeley 1964, referring to the student uprising at the University of California campus. There would be no such events on his watch. And therein, you begin to see the launching of this counter-revolution that is still motoring along in 2015, 50 years later.
Do you think that people get it about... I'm talking about those who are activists and others. I'm sure they have a greater understanding, in a sense. But do you think people generally get the idea that systems very seldom really change They remain remarkably consistent and remarkably resistant to change.
Well, as I said, I think that with the power of the right in the United States, which influences us all, it's very difficult to grasp that elementary point that you've just put forward. I should also say that when the Voting Rights Act of 1965 was inked, and when Watts went up in flames, this was not only influenced by the global factors that I've already articulated, that is to say, the rise of independence movements in Africa and Asia as well, but it's also influenced by the fact that the United States was in a Cold War with the former Soviet Union, trying to charge Moscow with human rights violations, but finding it difficult to do so when Jim Crow and apartheid pockmarked the landscape in North America. This created momentum as well for a retreat of Jim Crow and apartheid. But now, with the Soviet Union passing into history, with the United States under less international pressure to get its domestic act in order, understandably, there has been regression. Understandably, there have been great leaps backwards. The problem is that it's very difficult for many of our activists and many of our leaders to grasp that elementary insight.
So, as you observe, having written about Watts so authoritatively, and having observed what is going on in Ferguson, Missouri, what do you think would come of the current struggle in Ferguson?
Well, there's a lot of momentum in Ferguson. As a person who was born and raised in St. Louis, Missouri, not that far from Ferguson, Ferguson being a suburb of St. Louis, I've kept a close eye on trends there. And one of the keys to progress in Ferguson will be the fact that there is a fair level of organization there. Just, for example, beginning August 9th, just a day or two ago, you began to see this commemoration, and you saw this national call for 4.5 minutes of silence on August 9th, Sunday morning, at least Sunday morning when I was on the West Coast. And that sort of commemoration that was marked nationally doesn't happen without organization. I should also say that St. Louis also has some progressive trade union and union forces, too, who are in solidarity with the activists on the ground. But blurring that rainbow of positivity, I should add cautiously, is the fact that there is a very strong right-wing movement in St. Louis, Missouri. After all, St. Louis was a Jim Crow town. I experienced Jim Crow growing up there. And historically, it's been a hotbed for that kind of ultra-right sentiment that is all too familiar and common in the Euro-American community. Of course, St. Louis was also a case where the infamous Dred Scott case of 1857 was adjudicated. As a child growing up in St. Louis, I used to go to the old courthouse on forays and on school expeditions to see where that case was argued, a case where Justice Roger Taney of the U.S. Supreme Court said that the U.S. and white men, more particularly, were not bound to observe the rights of any black person or black man. And that kind of sentiment has yet to be purged from St. Louis, nor the United States as a whole, I might add.
And we can't escape the fact that this is happening, this turmoil and this resistance to the system is happening in an administration that had as the top law enforcement officer, Eric Holder, his successor, Loretta Lynch, African-Americans, an African-American president. Does this say something?
Yeah, it says quite a bit. I think one of the things I find interesting, if you do an analysis of U.S. politics, is that right now it appears that the president who will be sworn into office in January 2017 will be to the right of the president that is sitting in the White House today. What I'm trying to suggest to you is that despite our understandable and justifiable criticisms of the current occupant of the White House, with my major bill of indictment going, for example, to the unfortunate and perhaps illegal bombing campaign in Libya in 2011, which has opened the doors for turmoil, not only in North Africa, but in the Mediterranean and to a degree in Europe as well. Yet, it does appear that many of my fellow blue passport holders in the United States of America feel that the current president of the United States is dangerously to the left, which is why they're in the process of electing someone to his right. And what that tells me is that the country as a whole is moving dangerously to the right. And if you put it in a larger context, you'll see that it's unclear right now whether the United States will be launching a war against Iran, a country of 80 million people, with which the current occupant of the White House has tried to negotiate a nuclear accord, but which is facing tremendous pushback with your own senior senator from New York, Chuck Schumer, being in the vanguard, with another New Yorker, Norman Podhoretz, a leading Jewish American and pro-Zionist, pro-Israel intellectual, writing a piece in the Wall Street Journal a few days ago that's chilling and terrifying, where he says that the choice right now is either conventional war today with Iran or nuclear war in the future against Iran. Those are the two choices that he starkly presents. What I'm trying to suggest to you is that the United States has gone dangerously off kilter, moved dangerously and provocatively to the right, and unfortunately, the forces of the left are not able to get a grasp of the situation, or perhaps even if they were able to get a grasp of the situation, the fact that there is so much mass sentiment in the Euro-American community for these cockeyed right-wing notions means that once again we would have to call upon international support to rescue us.
We'll take this break and come back to matters international right after that. You're listening to PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. The program is Lead Stories, and our guest, Dr. Gerald Horn. We're hearing word from Ron Kirk, who was a U.S. trade representative, that the Trans-Pacific Partnership is about 90% done. What are your thoughts?
Well, let's hope that 10% is a weighty 10%, because that Trans-Pacific Partnership will be a further blow to poor and working class people in the United States of America, particularly on the West Coast, because given the fact that it's a Trans-Pacific Partnership, that augurs more an increased trade and investment from Asia Pacific nations into the United States of America, or alternatively, more jobs fleeing from the West Coast to Asia Pacific nations. Keep in mind as well that the Trans-Pacific Partnership explicitly excludes China and is seen as an attempt of encirclement of China an encirclement that, of course, is ratified by the fact that the United States has set up a military base in northern Australia. It's ratified by the fact that Japan, a major antagonist of Beijing, is moving to remilitarize, if you like, as exemplified by the fact that Vietnam, which is no friend of the regime in Beijing, despite the fact that both were ruled by communist parties, the leader of the Communist Party in Vietnam met with President Obama in the Oval Office just a few weeks ago, which was an extraordinary maneuver. And so this Trans-Pacific Partnership is not only bad in terms of the economics of the poor and working class communities, particularly the West Coast, but also is bad in terms of their own security, because believe it or not, there are more insistent voices in the national security establishment who are calling for a confrontation with China sooner rather than later, on the premise that with every passing day, China is getting stronger, and that it behooves the United States to do the confrontation now, when there is at least a ghost of a chance of the United States prevailing. This is very dangerous talk. You might even call it insane talk. But it's the kind of talk that increasingly is galvanizing a segment of the national security establishment in Washington.
But I'm going with the idea that this, I mean, how do we explain Barack Obama here? I mean, the president seems absolutely determined that this must happen. This is going to be his, the crown, the jewel in his crown. He has pushed it through and has done so even at great protest, even in Congress, apart from the unions, apart from organizations and so forth, who protest the central thing about the Trans-Pacific Partnership is the complete lack of transparency here. How has he been able to get away with this?
Well, as you know, the Democratic Party, of which Barack Obama is the titular leader, is an unwieldy, ungainly alliance between big business and unions and so-called minorities. That is to say, big business, particularly investment capital, such as capital represented by figures like George Soros and Warren Buffett, of the Oracle of Omaha, so-called, entertainment industry moguls like Jeffrey Katzenberg of DreamWorks, and Steven Spielberg, his business partner, and David Geffen, his other business partner. And then the AFL-CIO, which represents a union movement which has been severely wounded and has yet to recover from the Red Scare purges of a half century or more ago. And so-called minorities, particularly what a former NAACP leader used to call the big minority, meaning black Americans, who have yet to recover from their own purges they had to execute in the 1950s when they purged W.E.B. Du Bois and distanced themselves from Paul Robeson. And so they're basically the caboose on this Democratic Party train, of which Barack Obama is supposedly the chief engineer. What I'm trying to suggest to you is that even if you analyze to a fairly well the real and imagined abilities and frailties of Barack Hussein Obama, that'll only get you part of the way to a complete understanding of why this Trans-Pacific Partnership is on the fast track. It's in the fast lane, because those who are paying the bills, for the most part, that is to say, Warren Buffett and George Soros and Jeffrey Katzenberg, these are the forces who are pushing the TPP. And I might also add, lined up, if the TPP passes or passes muster, is the transatlantic counterpart of the TPP, which will be a double blow to the poor and working class. And likewise, this too has an anti-China slant, because there's hysteria in certain precincts in Western Europe as well about the rise of China. And therefore, it's felt that the North Atlantic nations have to circle the wagons, and I chose my metaphor carefully in reference to the European settlers who dispossessed the Native Americans of the far west over a century and a half ago. And once again, in order to understand what's going on, you have to understand this historical background, the economic background, and the political background, and see Barack Hussein Obama, even though he's a powerful figure, basically serving as the chairman of the board, if you like. And if any of you have ever chaired a meeting know that you only serve in that office as long as you reflect the will of the most powerful people in the meeting. And if you don't reflect their will, you usually are forced to resign or otherwise forcibly ousted.
Well, we talked about Obama's trip to Africa prior to his going, this fourth and likely final trip. He visited Kenya and Ethiopia. He attended also the 2015 Global Entrepreneurship Summit. And his message was business and entrepreneurship. In a way, is this something that, I mean, was this just a matter of, well, I messed up, I should have done it sooner, but I'm giving it all I can to boost some kind of trade between the United States and Africa, or is this a way of, symbolic way of setting up his post-presidential life, that he sees his fortunes tied somehow to business in Africa the way the Clintons have in other countries?
Well, one more point on Obama before we turn to Africa. One of the reasons I tried to provide that previous analysis is I think that there's sort of a delusion amongst many of our friends on the left. That is to say that if we could just replace Obama with Elizabeth Warren, that everything will be hunky-dory, pardon the expression, ignoring the underlying ideological factors, underlying the ideological backwardness of a good deal of the Euro-American working class, the fact that the labor movement and the black movement has yet to fully recover from the wounds inflicted during the McCarthy era. In other words, you're looking for this sort of easy way out, and then you elect Elizabeth Warren, say, in January 2017, and by January 2018, you're ready to throw her out and, I don't know, get Bernie Sanders. And I think that that kind of cycle has to stop at some point if we're not all going to wind up interned in Yankee Stadium in the Rose Bowl wondering how we got there. Now, with regard to Barack Obama's trip to Africa, this also was a trip that was haunted by the specter of China. That is to say that the building that he spoke in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, the headquarters of the African Union, was built as a gift from Beijing to the AU. And China's trade and investment now in Africa dwarfs that of the United States. The United States is trying to play catch-up ball, but unless something cataclysmic and catastrophic happens, that game is over, despite the best intentions of Barack Obama. And in any case, because of the political climate in the United States, just like a Barack Obama feels constrained and compelled to lecture black Americans about, you know, pulling up your pants and getting a haircut and all these other trivial irrelevancies, when he goes to Africa, he feels compelled to lecture them as well on various matters. Whereas, of course, if an African leader came to the United States for trying to lecture the United States about all of its weaknesses and frailties, people would wonder if this leader had lost his or her head. But in any case, besides China, the overriding factor is a weakness of Mr. Obama's own handiwork. That is to say, the security question. The security question in Africa plummeted precipitously after the NATO bombing and invasion of Libya in 2011. That weakened Mali. That had knock-on effects in Algeria, in Niger, in Chad, and arguably in the continent's giant, speaking of Nigeria and the Boko Haram crisis. That's not even to talk about what's happening on the eastern side of the continent, where with the resurgence of so-called religious zealotry of an Islamic character, you've seen these murderous attacks in Kenya, particularly in Mombasa, the major port on the Indian Ocean. And let's not even talk about the decline of Somalia, Kenya's neighbor, and let's not talk about the U.S. military base in Djibouti. This security question is taking up quite a bit of U.S. attention, making it very difficult for it to turn its attention to what it would like to address, which is the confrontation with China. But once again, that is largely a product of President Obama's own doing, because he did not have to overthrow the Gaddafi regime. It's not one of those situations where you can say, well, the right-wing forces were all powerful and they were mandating that Gaddafi be overthrown. You were around in 2011. You know that's not so. You know that Secretary of Defense Bob Gates, a holdover from the Bush years, was opposed to the overthrow of Gaddafi, and that Secretary of State Clinton and Samantha Power, now UN Ambassador, and Susan Rice, now National Security Ambassador, pushed for it aggressively and hawkishly. He took their advice, and now he has to reap the whirlwind.
But he still is very much focused on this business of business with Africa and all these countries that he is now also, which I think is a bit for those people who know how long Africans have been entrepreneurs, it almost sounds very paternalistic that the United States will now be mentoring African entrepreneurs to teach them how to do business. But one couldn't help but believe that somehow this visit, this coming home to Kenya, and was somehow a prelude to kind of setting up some kind of initiative, a la Clinton, the global Clinton initiative, now called what, the Clinton Foundation, whatever it is they're calling it now, that this is a kind of effort to set himself up for a post-presidency life.
Well, I don't know. I mean, that's informed speculation, and I won't dispute it. He, of course, spoke wistfully of his post-presidential days, which will be arriving sooner rather than later, and the ability to come back to East Africa. And I assume that with the Obama Presidential Library in Chicago, that that'll be a platform for ventures far and wide. So we'll know soon enough.
Well, let's talk about Greece for a minute. There is still a great deal of negotiation about whether Greece gets another bailout. And, of course, it's a cause of great tension. But Greece is one of approximately 24 nations that are teetering on the brink of bankruptcy. So this idea of bankruptcy is global. I shared with the audience just last week a tape by Yanis Varoufakis, who is the former finance minister, the Marxist former finance minister, who was talking about the fact that debt is not a problem. There's no crisis. There's no debt crisis. What there is in fact, huge surpluses that have nowhere to go. How do you assess this question of the global debt crisis?
Well, let's not look any further than the U.S. neo-colony that is Puerto Rico, which is now reeling, is now on the ropes. There has been some useful journalism of late about how a number of retirees invested their nest eggs in Puerto Rican bonds and now are being offered 18 cents on the dollar, as opposed to getting $1.18 for investing a dollar. They're going to get 18 cents for investing a dollar, which is obviously an unsustainable proposition. It also bespeaks the fact that Puerto Rico is now sinking precipitously, which inevitably will cause more islanders to try to seek their fortunes on the mainland, not least in Florida and in New York City. But I think in terms of the question that you're raising, to put it in a larger historical context, what we see in Europe is an analog of what we're seeing in Asia. What I mean is, we were just talking about the remilitarizing, the attempted remilitarizing of Japan. And in Europe, we see the strengthening of Germany and the ability of Berlin to dictate terms, not only to Athens, but ultimately to Madrid, ultimately to Dublin, ultimately to Rome. And in the larger context, what that suggests is that the U.S. attempt since 1945 to reverse the results of World War II, where Germany and Japan were on the losing side, are reaching fruition. Now, that's not to say, of course, that as those results reach fruition, that the United States will then rest on its laurels, because we all know that if the ultimate prizes are weakened, that is to say, Russia and Europe and China and Asia, and if Germany and Japan continue to rise, well, then the United States will then turn on Germany and Japan. And this heedless, needless cycle of conflict, which seeks as its ultimate goal to establish U.S. supremacy forevermore. And that is the issue, and that is the problem.
But you have the issue also of the European Union having its own problems, falling apart in some cases, and whether the euro would actually prevail against the U.S. dollar.
Well, it's even more complicated than that. When you speak of Europe falling apart, what my mind immediately zeroes in on is the question of Britain. That is to say that I think that there is a 50-50 chance that Britain will exit from the European Union. It's not a part of the euro, the common currency. It maintains the British pound. And what's interesting is that the United States, I believe, would prefer to see Britain stay within the European Union. I think that London's European counterparts may be of a different state of mind, which sets up at least a putative conflict between Berlin and Washington. But if Britain withdraws from the European Union, that will be a blow against the European Union, and that, of course, will complicate Washington's efforts to continue to see the European Union as a sword to be wielded against Moscow.
But when all is said and done, the U.S. dollar is not all that sound from what experts are saying, that the U.S. dollar, you consider the fact that the BRICS organization, Southeast Asia, they have basically consolidated their own money system, and they are no longer recognizing the U.S. dollar. So how does this affect the United States?
Well, I think that the United States' interest right now with regard to Europe is as much geostrategic as anything else. That is to say, it's still pursuing this crusade against Moscow, which you might want to question, given the fact that with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the Soviet Union's population shrinking as Moscow becomes the inheritor of Russia, you would think that Russia was considerably weakened to the point where it would not be a preoccupation of Washington. But if you look at the map and see that Russia is not only a storehouse of minerals and gold and diamonds, not least, but also the land bridge between what remains the richest continent, Europe, and what is the continent of the future, speaking of Asia, and also given its lengthy land border with China, which is already in the crosshairs of Washington, you begin to understand why you have this veritable obsession with Moscow in Washington, despite the weakened nature of Russia, as reflected in the fact that in the last quarter, apparently economic growth was minus 4.6%. And you would think that given that, that there would not be this obsession, but that, of course, would be an incorrect miscalculation.
What, therefore, as we sum up today, what do you think of from the topics that we've discussed, what do you think that people ought to be thinking about? What should be on their minds?
Well, we started off talking about Los Angeles and what happened 50 years ago. And as I said in my book on the topic, you can't begin to understand the conflagration that swept through 46 and a half square miles of Los Angeles County, an area larger than the island of Manhattan or the city of San Francisco, with tens of thousands of people taking to the streets. You can't understand that, what that spontaneity of uprising, without understanding the previous historical epic, that is to say, the weakening of the left, the McCarthy era, the Red Scare, etc., the weakening of the labor movement. And likewise, if we are to dig ourselves out of the hole in which we find ourselves, obviously we have to reverse that history. We have to reverse that history of regressive, rightward-leaning thinking and action that led to these events of August 1965. And, of course, reversing that action will help us to better stop the war machine, which, as I said, is talking about right now, as we speak, either conventional war against Iran today or nuclear war in the near future. Those kinds of nightmare scenarios cannot be reversed unless we begin to talk seriously about a revival and a resurgence of the progressive movement in North America and in the union movement, not least.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Gerald, for joining us today and for sharing so generously your knowledge and information, and I hope it was useful to the listening audience. You may want to look at that book by Gerald Horn, Watts, about the Watts Rebellion, titled Fire This Time, The Watts Uprising and the 1960s. Stay tuned. Coming up next, The Infectious Myth with David Crowe. I'm thankful and always grateful, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. We'll see each other tomorrow. Thanks for listening.